WWWS.
Call us to order 126. We have Representative Tula Rogeberg, James Green, my good friend Representative Croft. We have a quorum. And we're going to start with House Bill 300. Do we have anyone here for House Bill 300? This is a governor's bill. Barbara, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Were you going to provide the overview on House Bill 300?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Were you going to provide the overview on House Bill 300? Tell us what it does.
No, 1 second.
Recommend.
Sorry about that. My paper, I have to give it to somebody else. This is Barbara Nicholas, and I'm the director of the Child Support Enforcement Division. And we have requested that this bill be introduced because there's a problem. That's occurring with...
You out of breath?
I'm sorry.
Are you out of breath?
Yeah. I had to run and get my piece of paper. Sorry about that. Anyway, when people go on medical assistance, the child support agency is required to establish a medical support order. But the way that the statute reads right now, we must establish a financial support order along with the medical support order. That's a lot of breath. And this bill changes the law so that a medical support order only may be established, so that we would not also need to establish a financial child support order. Second, this bill amends the medical support statute to provide that either parent, not simply the obligor parent, may be required to provide health care coverage. Third, this bill amends the law to require that a medical support order be issued regardless of whether health care coverage is currently available to either parent. The bill was amended in the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. And the two things that the Hess amendments did is that it made it clear that CSED and the court followed the same procedures, and we would have no objection to that. And it also makes it clear that CSED can take enforcement actions to ensure that medical support compliance with the medical support order, that people comply with the medical support order, even in the absence of a financial support order. So those last two provisions were added in the Hess committee. The remaining, but the bill, the majority of the bill stays the same. We believe that this bill would help both the obligee, the person who has the child, the custodial parent, and the non-custodial parent, because we wouldn't have to be setting up these financial orders unless both parents wanted us to set up these orders. And we believe that the changes that were made in the Health, Education, and Social Services Committee are acceptable. We do have one issue, and it's my understanding that Shirley Dean had provided the committee members with a paper that says recommended change to the committee substitute for House Bill 300 that talks about the change that we'd like to see made to this legislation. And Diane Wendland is here with the Department of Law, and Diane would like to describe that, if that's all right.
Okay.
Yes, this is Diane Wendland, the Assistant Attorney General. Briefly, the change that has been recommended relates to Section 7, which is on page 7 of the bill. The request, the change that we have recommended is that the word government assistance be removed from line 12. As things stand right now, the primary focus of medical support is to ensure that there is insurance coverage for the child. But as things stand now, under Civil Rule 90.3, parents also have an obligation to essentially allocate the expenses that are not covered by insurance. So if a child is, you know, incurs medical expenses or those expenses are not covered by insurance, then under the administrative or court order, those costs are split. What the bill does, as currently drafted, it adds the language government assistance so that it says that the parents will, that the court or the agency will allocate medical expenses that are not covered by insurance or by government assistance. What that means, we have always interpreted the existing law to mean that if a child incurs medical expenses and those expenses are not covered by insurance, but government assistance, Medicaid usually, if Medicaid pays those expenses, then Medicaid would have the right to go after the parent for that parent's share of the uninsured expenses. By adding the word government assistance, there is a possibility that the bill eliminates that right. So we are suggesting that the word government assistance be removed so that we do not affect that right. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Representative Roegberg.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Nicholas, this is Representative Roegberg. You and I have had a number of discussions about this. But in the circumstances, in the case that you and I had last year, this would require that person, that obligor, to pay back any Medicaid expenses, even though he'd offered to pay for private health insurance. So I'm not so sure I agree with your suggested amendment.
The amendments came, in terms of our suggested amendments, it would just leave the door open, we have the door open right now in existing law. And in fact, that is not how we go about collecting medical assistance. The way we go about collecting medical assistance is if someone has reasonable health insurance available at a reasonable cost. But right now, existing law would allow us to collect financial payments. And that was actually something that the HEF committee felt pretty strongly about, at least in their discussion. They felt that instead of having the state pay for the public assistance, that if someone didn't have health insurance, or employer health insurance, but that if they were wealthy, that maybe they could be required to pay for the care. Under existing statute, they could be, although we don't do that right now. And we believe that if we don't change this amendment, then that would close that door.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had a situation where a friend of mine was, within 30 days of getting divorced and having a signed property agreement, the CDC went after him for increased child support and the fact that his wife had, somebody recommended she had been unemployed for a few weeks, had then gotten on Medicaid, and when you get on Medicaid, you can't get off for 6 months, even though a few weeks later she got a $25 an hour job. And he had the property settlement where he was fully responsible and agreed to pay for everything. It was turned into a complete chaos. But in this situation where he agreed to pay for anything, she took the opportunity to go on Medicaid and get all the kids' teeth fixed and took advantage of the whole thing. And then this would make him responsible for all those things that she took advantage of while making $25 an hour, because the state under its rules stupidly can't get that person off Medicaid for 6 months. It was one of those really strange things, notwithstanding the fact that the ink wasn't dry on the property agreement and he fulfilled all of his obligations. So I'm not real happy with it. Some of this is good. It takes care of some of this in this bill, but that section there I'm not sure is valid. When somebody has the right to get themselves on Medicaid or Denali Kid Care, and then they can go after the obligor even though he had nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Other comments? Opposed amendment? Okay. Is there anyone else here in general wish to testify in House Bill 300? Anyone else on the teleconference line? Seeing none. What's the wishes of the committee on this one?
Come on, Lisa. Get it out of here.
You gonna blow it up?
Wait. What is the suggestion by Barbara Miklos on this top thing where she's suggesting a an amendment.
She's suggesting eliminating the words on page 7, line 12, government assistance.
Would you also take the word?
Somebody explain that to me again, what that does.
This allows, by taking that, allows the state to go after the obligor for the payments made under a state Medicaid or other program. Like the Denial of Kid Credit, I think that's what it says. That was a testimony. I might ask Ms. Mikolo. She can even respond to my statement if she'd like.
Barbara, did you hear the comment?
Yes, I did. And I would choose to respond to Representative Brokenberg's statement, especially the part where the case that he talked about, that's exactly one of the reasons that we wanted to introduce this bill. Right. Because those people had reached an agreement in terms of the property settlement, and because of state law, we had to tie financial assistance into medical assistance. So that was the reason that we introduced this bill, because we think it would help both parents, especially in cases like that. Regarding the amendment, we believe that an existing statute that we could, for instance, ask someone to pay for costs, or Medicaid could ask someone to pay for costs, not child support, even if they don't have health insurance. And this was an issue that was very important in the HES committee, because there were people that really felt that people should be paying for the children's health care costs and not using public money. We believe that the words government assistance in there would then preclude us from doing that. By keeping government assistance on page 7, lines 9 through 13, then we would not be able to go for things other than health insurance. And it is a policy call. It does affect Medicaid. I don't know if anyone is there for Medicaid. It is not something that anyone is collecting right now. We are just going after health insurance at a reasonable cost. And that's kind of the focus. And we've chosen that focus because we believe it's the most cost effective. But we didn't know we prefer not to have language in the law that would preclude us in any circumstances in going after other things.
Does M. James get that?
I got it.
Well, I don't.
Representative Groff.
I apologize, Barbara, for being confused on this. So you were looking at page 7, starting on line 9.
Oh, well, maybe I'm reading the wrong page.
No, it's 12. That's right.
That's right. Oh, you're line 12.
You're fine. You're good. I'm just confused. In
7, line 12.
If you'd help me through it. Except as otherwise provided in this subsection for uncovered expenses exceeding $5,000, the court or an agency shall allocate equally between the parents the cost of reasonable health care expenses not covered by private insurance, and then we say our government insurance. Joe's right, we need to take out the or as well. But so if we keep it as it's written, we say we shall allocate it, but not those covered by private or government. So if one party, the kids are covered by Medicaid, you couldn't allocate that part, and Medicaid might be able to come back after you, after the non-custodial parent? Does that mean yes?
Yes, that's correct.
She signified if it's
no.
She didn't
hear that.
Mr. Rugberg.
Mr. Chairman, I speak against adopting the amendment because I think that the programs and the care available under Medicaid is greater than almost anybody can receive in a private insurance plan in the state of Alaska. So it's unequal care. You get better insurance coverage with Medicaid, by and large, because it doesn't have the exclusions or caps or limits, for example, on vision, dental, and other things like that, which sometimes may be somewhat discretionary.
Well, Barbara, sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
Barbara keeps saying you have a right and compelling example, and you're coming to the wrong conclusion from it. In fact, that what she's trying to do helps that situation. I mean,
I agree with that, but not this particular part of it. That's all. I agree with the bill, absolutely.
Representative Kutula.
This part of it, Barbara, is, am I understanding you correctly? What this part of it's going to do is, if you are getting government assistance, it still allows you to go back to custodial, non-custodial parent to get reimbursed. Is that right?
For uncovered expenses. So it presumes those expenses that are not covered by health insurance. And it would leave that door open to go after those expenses. Whereas if you leave the words in government assistance in there, we're worried that that door would be closed.
Well, if, Mr. Nicholas, is my example good? If you had an insurance plan, the obligor had in, like major medical coverage, but didn't have dental coverage, and you, and the children got their teeth fixed under a Medicaid program like Denali Kid Care, this would give you the right to come back to the obligor and ask for a reimbursement for the dental plan.
Yes, which we have under existing law.
Yeah, that's right.
No. And which some members of the health committee at least felt fairly strongly we should do that.
I don't think it's fair.
I don't think it's fair.
So, and this is Beth again, so even if the government covered it, you'd be able to go back against the custodial, non-custodial parent?
Correct.
For the uncovered cost.
The uncovered. Yeah. Representative James.
Mr. Chairman, quite frankly, when we're talking about that, the Denali Kid Care, that's been portrayed as an insurance policy for folks. Now you're saying if they take that insurance policy that they can be held responsible for the amount of the cost of it?
Really?
It is possible for people to have health insurance and be on Denali Kid Care. What we definitely want is for us to be able to, us being the state, to be able to get the reimbursement for that health insurance. And it might not pay the full cost of care because, as Representative Roford said, sometimes the Medicaid insurance program might have higher benefits than the private insurance policy. And so whether you took that in or left it out, the amendment that we suggested, it wouldn't affect the issue that Representative James is talking about. The issue that we're talking about is for the uncovered expenses. Mm-hmm. And uncovered in this sense, although the truth is, it's very hard for me to understand this sentence because there's so many double negatives that I, every time I read it, I get a little confused again.
That's right.
But it would be our perception that for those expenses not covered by private insurance, that we right now can go after people monetarily, as Representative Roper suggested. By leaving those words in there, this would preclude us from doing that. I then need to say we're not doing that. I don't know that we would start anytime soon, but it is something that if someone were very, very wealthy but didn't have health insurance and their child was on Medicaid, then the state might want to consider going after that person financially.
Representative James.
Well, thank you. I'm beginning to see the picture here, but I've been totally confused from the very beginning. What you're saying now, and I tend to agree with that, that if a, first of all, my first question is, if they have an insurance policy and they also have Denali Kid Care, which is the first payer?
Well, I'm assuming Denali Kid Care, I don't know if anyone from Medicaid is in the audience, but my assumption is from what I know how it works is Denali Kid Care would be the payer, and then they would seek reimbursement from the insurance policy. And Medicaid does that.
I'm John Sherwood with the Division of Medical Assistance. Normally, for most kinds of services, if someone has insurance, the provider has to bill the private insurance first. Medicaid only pays for what's uncovered by the insurer. For certain kinds of services that aren't commonly paid for by insurance, the provider can bill Medicaid first, and we do try and go after the insurance company after the fact.
Senator James?
Yeah, some more questions on this because I'm beginning to get clouded up in here. And that is to see the reality of this is we put the Denali Kid Care out there for particular people who either are underinsured or not insured to be able to cover, and the issue is to be able to cover children's medical expenses. And nowhere in that advertisement of Denali Kid Care did I ever see anything or know anything about that, okay, if you get this benefit, you're going to have to pay it back. Is that, am I missing something?
Well, in most cases, you would not, the client would not pay it back. Where, if I understand this the proposed change correctly, in situations where there was a child support order in place that addressed medical support and specifically required the non-custodial parent to pay for a portion of the health care costs directly, then the non-custodial parent would be required to pay something.
If I might follow up, and I'm beginning to get the picture now, because I understand that with the agreement, child support plus medical coverage is what you keep a coverage and you pay it. Then how does that, if that's the case, and the custodial parent has to pay this, why would the custodial parent, if the non-custodial parent had to pay that, why would the custodial parent need Denali Care? And why would they qualify?
I believe in most cases the medical support order would still be limited in the amount of money that an individual had to pay for the care. And they might still need Denali KidCare to pay for things that were outside the coverage of the financial ability of the two parents.
Follow up on this. Who makes the application for the Denali KidCare? The obligor or the custodial parent? Because it seems to me like that if the custodial parent's not paying these and has an obligation from someone else to pay them, they ought not to be able to apply for Denali KidCare.
The custodial parent would be the one generally who will make the application for Denali KidCare. It's the custodial parent that would apply.
That sounds like a ripoff to me.
Rips and crops.
I'm still confused. And let me just try and get some numbers down so it can fit into my simple sort of framework on it. 10,000 of 30,000 of which 10,000 is covered by private insurance, 10,000 covered by Medicaid, and 10,000 that's uncovered, just so we get all the possibilities out there. And under the bill as it stands, you shall allocate equally between the parents the cost of reasonable health care expenses not covered. That's 10,000 of it. We split it 5,000 and 5,000. We say non-custodial parent, you owe 5,000 for these non-covered medical expenses. Right? That's the way the bill as drafted works. Pay up for your half of what wasn't covered for the kid's medical care. Is that right?
I defer to child support enforcement as the...
Barbara, did you hear that?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then, but if we adopt the amendment and we take out or government assistance, then it'll be the cost of reasonable health care expenses not covered by private insurance. Well, that's 10,000 on one and 10,000 on the Medicaid. So now that's 20,000, and you're going to split that equally. And so I'm going to send a bill to the non-custodial parent of $10,000. And when the custodial parent gets it, they take the five and use it for the non-covered, and they take five of it and send it back to Medicaid, right? Or should.
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and it makes sense that we should charge the non-custodial parent for government services, but not for private insurance covered. And when it was just the uncovered, it sort of made sense to me. Why should we distinguish between the two and charge the non-custodial for paying back Medicaid?
This is Diane Wendland again. My understanding of the reasoning is that government assistance is not supposed to be a substitute for the parental responsibility in paying for these expenses. These expenses would have been paid and allocated between the parents if the government assistance were not available. And the argument, policy argument, is that government assistance should not act as a substitute and reduce the liability of the non-custodial or obligor parent for these expenses.
Okay.
This is Barbara Miklas. If I could add a couple things. One, in terms of what Representative James was talking about, it almost is, what happens is that when someone applies for a Medicaid program, including Denali Kid Care, that's when that triggers us to go after a medical support order. So then we find out if it can be reimbursed. And it can be from either parent, not just obligor. Secondly, as Diane was saying, that the intent behind this, the policy behind this, would be for the parents to be responsible if possible. And lastly, we are really not doing that. We are using insurance at a reasonable cost. But there may be a circumstance when either child support or the court would believe that the parent could afford, and most likely if it's a custodial parent, they wouldn't be on any kind of assistance, so I'm going to assume it's the non-custodial parent, could afford to help out with something other than insurance. And therefore, they might want to include that in the order. We're just concerned that this would preclude that, but it is not something that we do commonly, and it's not something that the court does commonly. So we wouldn't ask every single non-custodial parent to, in your situation, Representative Croft, we don't ask non-custodial parents to pay that $10,000 or $20,000 because it isn't reasonable.
Representative Roakberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think we in the situation that I was involved in, I wasn't, but my friend was, the he got divorced, and in the child support order agreed to pay half of their medical bills, but he didn't have an insurance policy. And therefore, when his ex-wife got Medicaid coverage, that triggered this whole deadbeat dad scenario, which took him like a year to get off his back when he met all the obligations and was prepared to meet all the obligations. So in my opinion, the use of a Medicaid assistance was, and for a protracted period, was discretionary on the part of the mother. And in this case, he'd be charged back, even though he'd agreed to pay half of all the bills, all of a sudden. Yeah. But then, because of the breadth of scope of coverage provided by Medicaid, she took advantage of it and had all the teeth work and had everything in the kitchen sink done on, and you know, discretionary medical services. That's the trouble. There's no cost containment in Medicaid. It's the biggest fee-for-service thing we have in the state. Anyway.
Representative James.
Well, my concern is this. It seems to me like that when there is a separation, and then we have a non-custodial and a custodial parent, that the arrangement through the courts for the child support will also say whatever the non-custodial parent is to pay. Now, if the non-custodial parent is to pay, not only provide insurance, but to pay the part that's not covered by the insurance, then it seems to me like under child support, there would be a valid reason to go after that person, because that was the court agreement on the child support issue, and then they would have a right to go after them. But let's say that all they were required to do was provide insurance, and that the out-of-pocket or non-covered was to be paid by the custodial parent. It seems to me like, that being the case, that if there was anyone going after anybody, they'd have to go after the custodial parent. However, if the custodial parent, in their zealousness to be sure that they're covered on everything, make application to Denali Kid Care, I don't believe that they believe that they're going to have to pay that back. That's my problem. It seems to me like there's a little entrapment there in that mm-hmm. whole process, because, and in order to apply for Denali Kid Care, you have to meet certain wage parameters. You have to have some parameters there to do that. And if you're going to go after the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent because it says such and such a thing, then the wages of both of them ought to be included as to whether or not they are entitled for Denali Kid Care. I mean, I like giveaway programs and I like to take care of kids, but I don't want to entrap parents, and I don't want to give something to somebody if they have the ability already to pay, which it seems to me like they're talking about people here who happen to have extra money. that we should be able to go after them. If it isn't part of the court order that sets up the child support and the parameters of the child support, then I say no. We shouldn't be putting anything into law that would allow them to be entrapped in this way and go after them and put them on the spot for this. I think that's that. I don't know. I'd like to have Barbara respond to that, because certainly if they've agreed to pay and the court says they have to pay, they should pay.
Representative James, if I may respond. Most of these orders, or many of these orders in these cases, the one Representative Roper is talking about notwithstanding, but most of these orders are developed after people go into Denali Kid Care. And they are, it is made clear to people when they go into Denali Kid Care that the child support agency will be going after a medical support order. So in that sense, I don't think it's entrapment. And we do not go after, again, we don't go after the custodial and non-custodial parent that can't afford to pay these uncovered costs. It has to be reasonable by everybody's definition, and the word reasonable is throughout the statute. So the only way that we would collect is if, for instance, we found out that a custodial parent really had health insurance and maybe hadn't disclosed that or got it after they got on Denali Kid Care, then they could be ordered to use their health insurance just like the non-custodial parent could be ordered. But we will not, I mean, we do not do things that we haven't warned the parents about. I mean, the non-custodial parent obviously doesn't necessarily know there's going to be an order, but the custodial parent does know that they have to cooperate with child support.
Well, Barbara, just to follow up, and I know that your concern is about child support. So we're only talking in this particular case about those parents who are separated and there's a custodial and a non-custodial parent. But what might, and I don't know what the answer is to the folks that are not separated and they have Denali Kid Care, and maybe someone knows here. And so we're not talking about those folks. We're only talking about those folks who are split up. We're treating split up folks different than we're treating people who are not split up, and is that because that they have more money or what?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is specifically that's the federal requirements, but there's a reason behind it, not just that it's a federal requirement, and that is that if they're not split up, then I'm assuming that part of, and Mr. Sherwood could comment, but that part of the Denali Kid Care would be to take both of those parents' ability to have insurance or whether they have insurance would already have been taken into consideration. So it's sort of only when the parents are split up that people don't know if this other parent could possibly get the health insurance.
But if I might follow up just a little bit more, but if they come into a good job or some money and they get insurance, then they're supposed to report that to you or something, and then they could be falling off? Or do they have to pay it back?
I think Mr. Sherwood should answer that.
Yes, if somebody receives insurance after they come onto Denali Kid Care, they're required to report it to us, at which point their providers will have to begin billing insurance first. Their period of eligibility, they may still remain eligible for Denali Kid Care. We would pay the uncovered costs. In answer to your earlier question, where there isn't an absent parent, we do not pursue any kind of support or recovery, but as Ms. Miklos stated, both the parents' income is taken into consideration when we look at whether or not the child is eligible. Under federal law, when there is an absent parent, we are required to disregard their income and their financial resources when we do an eligibility determination. But the kind of the backside of that is that there is a requirement that we seek medical support for the child from that absent parent if it's available at reasonable cost.
President Roberg?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sure, is that seeking that availability of health, is that a federal mandate?
Yes, it is. It's a requirement.
And just out of curiosity, the technical point here, if we have somebody in this type of a situation that qualifies for Medicaid, either Denali Kid Care or under normal circumstances when there is a support order outstanding, how long are they enrolled in Medicaid, even if, in my circumstances I found, is that even though they got a job, they stayed on the rolls for some length of time. What's the procedure there?
For children, once they're determined eligible, they remain eligible for a minimum of 6 months. And for families that receive coverage under, it used to be the Medicaid provided to AFDC recipients, now it's split off from cash and called Family Medicaid. If they lose their eligibility because they have earnings, their earnings put them over, they go back to work, there's a up to 12 months of transitional coverage. Again, that's a federal requirement that we provide transitional Medicaid coverage for people who work their way off. It was initially intended to people who work their way off cash assistance. Welfare reform kind of split that off, but it's the same basic idea. So it's considered a support for people who are trying to work their way out of poverty.
So my fact pattern could be accurate then, even though the woman got a $25 an hour job within literally days after qualifying, the kids stayed on for 6 months. That's a terrible defect in the law. It's federal law, though, I think.
It's federal law. I think those things are intended to encourage people to take the chance to get a job and try and work their way out of poverty. Often, the threat of losing health care benefits can be a big barrier to trying to get back to work.
So. No, I understand that. But.
It's taking me a long time on this, but it does seem to me that if you've got a family who is qualifying for government assistance, is in either in poverty or close enough to it that they qualify under the guidelines, the question we're addressing in this amendment is, should the non-custodial parent pay part of, usually half of, the government's cost in helping them? So you've got a family who is in poverty or close, and a non-custodial parent who can pay, and the government stepping in to help. Should they or shouldn't they pick up half of that? Finally understanding that, I believe that they should. But I do think Representative Roekberg has a point that Barbara addresses with the reasonable all the way through. Particularly on the last line of the bolded section, reasonable uncovered expenses shall be allocated based on the parent's relative financial circumstances. Reasonable health care expenses. I think the solution to get us out of his example was redoing all the teeth in the kitchen thing, or whatever he said, reasonable medical expenses. And if CSCE has the power to say, no, those were not, where you provided them basic medical care, through Denali Kid Care, we're going to charge you half of that. We're not going to charge you half of the dental work. And I think now, after looking at it over and over, that is the structure it sets up. And for that reason, I think taking more government assistance out, I think the non-custodial parent who leaves children at or near poverty ought to be responsible for at least half of what we do to help those children.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Roekberg.
I don't disagree with what Representative Cross says, but my actual real world experience here doesn't lend any credibility to the word reasonable in this area. Matter of fact, I mean, the amount of constituent complaints I get about the very unkindly, and I don't think deserve it, Gestapo tactics of this division tends to be more normal than otherwise. So I don't have the level of credibility about the reasonableness standard just doesn't hold it for me. Particularly, what should be done here is the differentiation of uncovered benefits, because that's where I think the abuse is. Because I wouldn't disagree with you otherwise, if the regular medical insurance and other things were covered. But some of these other issues become problematic. Plus, I guess there is a $5,000 cap on it, I think. Mm-hmm. Or actually $10,000.
Mr. Representative Croft.
Well, what about some language then, Representative Roakberg, at the end that talks about reasonable uncovered expenses is, some definition that is closer for you. It doesn't include discretionary cosmetic type stuff. You do a lot more work in this insurance area than I do, but there's got to be that type of language distinguishing between needed medical services and cosmetic or other medical services.
Well, I'm not sure how the uncovered expenses exceeding $5,000 a calendar year. That's actually like a big, huge deductible. So if most vision and other stuff could be excluded there. So maybe my concerns could be looked at with that deductible, but I just don't have a lot of comfort on it. Because I think that it's subject to abuse, and the fact that I know about an instant case that was hit the perfect, I'm sure that's probably much the exception. But on the other hand, with the governor's aggressiveness and expanding this thing, and some of the stories I've heard about that, I'm concerned about that, too.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure what the fix would be.
Representative Murkowski.
And this would be a question for both Barbara and Mr. Sherwood. Is there anything out there in the statutes that would help us get closer to this, to what is reasonable uncovered expenses?
This is Barbara Miklos, and actually the definition of reasonable we take from the federal government, and their definition right now is that it's insurance provided by the employer at a reasonable cost. So they have not even expanded it further than that, and that's the definition we're using.
Well, we're talking about uncovered expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, we have not been going after uncovered expenses.
But now you would be able to.
No, under existing law, we are able to. We've chosen not to do that because it's not cost effective, and we're not required by federal law to do that. What we're concerned about by leaving this words in here, that we in the courts would be precluded from ever doing that. But under existing law, we believe, if you didn't even put in this change in the statute, we believe that we could go after uncovered expenses. And in fact, in some court cases, they have, but it's very rare.
Representative James.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. But Barbara, the uncovered expenses from the examples that we had would seem to be a benefit to the custodial parent in these cases, because who else is going to pay the uncovered if they're just out there billing to the custodial parent? And if that parent, it's hard for me to visualize they'd be uncovered if they have an insurance and they also have Denali Kid Car, but I don't know exactly how those pay. But am I to understand that there likely is uncovered even after having the insurance and Denali Kid Care? And if that is something then that the custodial parent would have to pay? And that if you did it, any kind of took any action on that, there would be no benefit to the state. It would only be benefit to the custodial parent. If that may be the reason why you never do it.
It's rare that we go after either parent, custodial or non-custodial parent, for uncovered expenses. And I don't know that it's ever happened when there's been health insurance. For instance, when the non-custodial parent has had health insurance. I think that the uncovered expenses are viewed more when neither party has insurance, and then they ended up splitting the cost of health insurance. But when the court does this, they do weigh each person's income. And normally it's equally, but it could be unequal depending on how much the income is. All of it is based on the parent's income. So going back to your scenario and the custodial parent being on Denali Kid Care, they're very close to poverty. Assuming that the non-custodial parent is wealthy, then there would be an opportunity to go after that parent. If the non-custodial parent was also poor, then no one would go after either one of them.
But follow up, Barbara, isn't it possible that the court order establishing the child support would indicate whether or not that non-custodial parent is supposed to keep an insurance in effect and also pay the co-payment? Because I've known of those cases.
The court order reads that if the parent has insurance at a reasonable cost, then it must be provided for their children. Actually, most of this whole program is geared toward people that could have insurance available but choose not to cover their children. So that's how the court order reads. There's also a provision in the court order that if there are uncovered costs, they could be split equally, depending on the circumstances, between the parents. And maybe Diane could comment, because I don't think that that's used that often.
Yes, this is Diane. I've only seen that used in a few cases. As a general rule, CSED enforces those kind of uncovered expenses only after the parents have gone to court and asked the court to reduce those expenses to judgment. And we don't generally get involved in that, but you know, having reviewed a few where that has come up, it is in front of the court, and then the court decides whether the expenses were reasonable, whether the medical treatment was necessary, was it at reasonable cost, and given the relative financial abilities of the parents, who should bear the burden of those costs. And once the court has made those decisions and reduced an amount to judgment, then CSED will enforce that judgment. So that's how it comes up now in the context where you don't have any government assistance.
Well, and just follow up on that, the reason I'm asking this question is that was the order that my daughter had in her divorce, you know, 20 years ago, and that the husband was supposed to maintain the insurance and also pay the co-payment, so that if she took her children to the doctor, whatever it cost her, he was supposed to reimburse her. And that's where I got that. Maybe they're not doing that anymore, but that was the way the rule was with them. Kids are all grown up now, having families of their own, but that was what he was supposed to do.
We are certainly doing that if he has insurance available. I mean, and that's the whole purpose of our enforcement.
I have another question, Mr. Chairman, to the Attorney General. I'm looking at the page 7 and the sentence that starts on page 2, line 2 ends on line 6. As if the obligor has a duty to make periodic payments for non-medical child support, the obligor's periodic payments shall be decreased by the amount of the other parent's portion of the payments for health insurance ordered by the court or agency and actually paid by the obligor. Then there's a reverse one the obligee has, that I believe. But what if there's an agreement in, let's say, a property settlement that's been approved by the court? Wouldn't that take precedence over this? You don't seem to give any privity of contract here at all.
I think your question is, if there's a court order, normally a property settlement would be approved by the court.
Right.
Therefore, becomes a court. The court issues an order based on that property settlement. That is what the court order is, and that's what we would enforce.
What you have a formula here that seems to be, it could be at odds with the agreement made in that court order or that property agreement.
I'm not entirely sure I understand the question, but I think that perhaps the sentence that precedes, it starts on section page 6, the very final line. The court or agency shall allocate equally the cost of health care insurance for the child between the parents unless there is good cause to allocate the costs unequally. If you have a property settlement that resolves these issues in a different way, because there's some particular reason for that different allocation, then I think that you would have a good cause exception. You could allocate it other than equally, and then there would be no increase or decrease as provided in lines 2 through 9.
Well, it's my problem is that every day CSED abrogates the privy of contract in property settlement agreements by changing the amounts of custodial support payments based on alleged increases in income and things of that nature. So, well, I don't know. Man. Anyway, we have other things to do, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Roberg, thank you for those comments. Just so we have something to discuss and can get to a vote, I'd move that on page 7, line 12, we delete the words "or government assistance" as recommended by Barbara.
I'll object.
I knew we would finally get there.
Have to sometime, I think.
All right, motion is to adopt amendment number 1, which removes the words "or government assistance" on lines 12, page 7, and there is an objection. Additional discussion on the motion. Okay. That being the case.
Representative Petula.
Yes.
Representative Green.
Yes.
Representative Roper.
No.
Representative James.
No.
Representative Murkowski.
Yes.
Representative Croft.
Yes.
Chairman Cott.
Yes. So the amendment is adopted. Brings us back to the main bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
My only concern now is the shall in there. And Representative Crutula and I have been talking some about it. The shall on line 11. So I want to leave, to respond to Representative Roberg's and concerns, a lot of which were surprisingly valid. And I'd like to make sure that they retain the discretion. And I'm it's a weird sentence. All of it's double negatives, but just the part, the court shall allocate equally between this, and we just defined it, unless you show good cause. Mm-hmm. That seems to be, I mean, there's two ideas really that are melded together here. One is, the court may order that the non-custodial parent do this, and you get the discretion to do or not do. And then you could get in the idea, if you decide to order it, you shall make that equal unless there's some good reason not to. So I think they've compressed two ideas. One is, if you decide this is an appropriate thing to do, you may reach out to the non-custodial parent, but you don't have to. But if you do that, you should generally do it equally unless there's a real good reason not to. Now, I don't know how to say that any better than that, but I'd like that sentence to read there. And I guess I'd ask Barbara, does any of that make any sense on dividing the two ideas into you may do it, and if you do it, you should presume it's equal unless otherwise found?
Yes, it does make sense.
Wow. Okay.
Wow.
I can see your question now, and it was not intended that we shall always do that.
Representative Petula.
There's another part to this drafting problem, and it's in, I mean, I didn't understand what you were saying, Barbara, because I thought it was a shall until I read the end of the section with the reasonable uncovered expenses, you know, shall be allocated based on the parent's relative financial circumstances, and I think that's got to be, I think the drafting should be, so that's together with the other part of the section. Otherwise, I think you've just got it really confused.
That's an excellent point. We got two.
You've got three different ideas going on. You've got splitting it up unless it's unreasonable, and then also allocating equally unless there's a reason not to. So really, you should determine what the reasonable costs are. You should allocate them equally unless there's a good reason not to. Wouldn't that be the way to put it together?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Croft.
I think Representative Crutula has a point. I mean, there's three ideas. You can do this if you decide to, but you don't have to.
Right.
And then the two that are left are contradictory almost the way they're written. One says you shall do them equally, and the other, unless there's a good reason, the other says you shall do them based on financial. Which am I supposed to shall do?
Right.
You know?
Right.
Am I supposed to? They've got different financial circumstances. One tells me to do it equally. The other tells me to look at those. And, I mean, I guess the combination that all works is you may allocate this to the non-custodial parent if you want. If you decide to, you shall allocate them equally. unless there's good cause, including the relative financial circumstances of the parties, to do otherwise.
That's, no, that's...
If you want to, you shall.
Well, if you want, if you decide to do it equally unless you got a good reason not to. Mm-hmm. So don't just always do it and do it 100%. If you, if this is a thing to do, do it equally unless you give a good reason not to do it.
Well, Barbara, which way do you really prefer it? Do you want it done equally unless you make a determination, or do you want to go right toward making a determination on the financial ability of the parents and not deal with doing it equally?
If you can get a little more specific, I have a general idea, but if you can get at what lines you want to change.
Can I try a conceptual amendment then, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Croft, we'll try a conceptual amendment if we can get there. If we can't, then we'll work on it overnight and get the concrete amendment.
I would move a conceptual amendment that replaces two sentences on page 7. The sentence that starts on line 9 and ends on line 13, and the sentence that starts on line 17 with reasonable and ends on line 20. Delete those two sentences and replace it with a sentence or sentences that say that the court may order the non-custodial parent to pay the uncovered expenses exceeding $5,000 for reasonable health care expenses, period, I guess, and that if they do make such an award, it shall be allocated equally between the parents unless there's good cause, including the relative financial circumstances of the parties, to allocate them unequally.
Representative Tula.
Through the chair, didn't you start that out by saying one parent was going to?
Yeah, he did.
I think the start of it wound up
wrong. He said he went from the obligor to both.
Right.
That's
right.
Confusing.
So it has to start,
it has to
with
start
both.
Out with both. Then I think you've got it.
Okay.
It wasn't our best shot. The best we've ever done.
Last hour.
We've got
just one.
Council has a question.
Clarification. So instead of ordering non-custodial parent, instead of starting at that vantage point, order both parents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
On the 5,000 language, and then if they do so, it should be done equally unless there's good cause.
Based on parents' relative financial circumstances.
Including.
Right. Including.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got okay, it. Including, sir.
Could be other stuff.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Okay.
Everybody got the concept?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with me.
Okay with you? Quite conceptual.
Mr. Chairman.
Got it.
Okay. Don't be nervous. Don't feel with the weight of the
world. I've got it.
But you
have
a third conceptual amendment?
In the same area?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
In the same area?
It won't screw that up. No.
Okay. Well, then.
So we're clear. That's adopted.
So the conceptual amendment as offered, is there objection to that?
No.
We'll make the changes in the areas necessary.
Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned about what the privity of contract and what I consider the original property settlement agreement to be. So I would add a small subsection B to this Section 7 language, which would be, or actually it'd be C, it'd be D, I'm sorry, it'd be small d under here, and say this is conceptual. What I'm trying to do here is get the original property settlement agreement language to be controlling, and it's as ratified by the court. So, I mean, that's where it's conceptual, because I'm not sure it can be just say the court support order or the... I really want to have the original agreement to be controlling in this. And say, you know, so if say, and then so the conceptual amendment would be, for the purposes of this section, the original property settlement agreement ratified by the court shall be considered a good cause. Because the good cause standards in throughout this is used by that, is good cause. And that was the testimony of the Attorney General, saying that that would be good cause. Yeah, because I think there is the potentiality, the possibility, and the reality that the department and the division changes these things with their extraordinary power. So to me, that defeats the privity of contract if you make an agreement. And there's agreement to that, and the court reviews it and ratifies it. And their argument would be there would be changing circumstances, but that would be a good cause, I think.
Barbara, did you hear the conceptual amendment?
Yes, I did.
You have any comments?
And we think it's fine, both Dan Whitland and I.
It's fine?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Croft.
I'll let it go with that, because they know much more about this area than I do. All I know about child support is that it's generally not subject to negotiation for good policy reasons. It's set by rule, and it's certain percentages of income, and you don't want this negotiated down, because you're worried in a lot of situations about, I won't fight you for custody if you agree to take X or Y, so after a lot of experience in general in setting child support across the nation, they just decided we ought to do it on a straight percentage of whatever you're making and not have it be negotiable because of a lot of problems that can come in. But I take it, Barbara, that's not interfering with Rule 90.3's rate setting, amount setting, child support setting power.
This is all just for the section on cause.
I know, but it's under that court rule.
Is that right, Barbara?
Same, Wendless. My understanding of the conceptual amendment is not that it would make a property settlement agreement controlling, which you're right, Representative Croft, it could not be controlling. It's not something that is entirely subject to negotiation by the parties. On the other hand, my understanding of the conceptual amendment was that it's merely something that could be considered in making a good cause determination on the allocation of covered expenses. I don't believe that that would be a violation of 90.3, which also includes good cause exceptions from guidelines.
Okay. That understanding, that's fine.
Okay, so that conceptual amendment is amendment number 3. Is your objection to that? Okay. That objection, then we have adopted amendment number 3.
Mr. Chairman.
Further amendments.
Mr. Chairman,
Roberg.
I move that we move from committee House Bill 300 as amended, and there was a recommendation and fiscal note. Notes as applicable.
That's the motion. Is there objection? There is a fiscal note. At 0. See no objection, and the bill is advanced.
I was confused, then I got clear. I think I'm back to confused.
Yeah, that was another Lauterbachism you had to clean up. Jesus. And I have a prostate problem.
I don't want to hear any more.
It goes with age.
Okay. Now that we've completed the administrative requirements of that one, Mr. Baldwin, House Bill 425. Committee has seen before.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Baldwin from the Attorney General's Office. Last time we met on this bill, I left with you some amendments which were specifically put forward to address some points that were raised by the Legislative Affairs Legal Division. And I have reviewed this draft CS as it's come back, and I believe those amendments are fairly picked up in this draft CS.
Which is G?
Which is
415
by Bannister. And I have no issues with the bill. I know we went over this rather quickly last time. If there's any questions, I'd like to answer them. Other than that, I just want to be on the record that I'm satisfied with the draft CS.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to say something. False claims, misrepresentations, false statements, and the failure to close. Could we get a Mike Dugan amendment on this?
You don't have.
Uh-oh.
You have G?
Uh-oh. I just like the title here. Make it applicable to the two newspaper columnists.
Just make it up. You've got the memo, right? 415.
Make it a capital offense.
Yeah. You can have mine. If you want to pass that on down, I don't have that.
Okay. On top of the April 15th amendment from Legal Services.
Oh, thank you.
No editorial.
Okay. So. Are we reading from the right page now?
I think so.
Chairman.
Representative Roberg.
Move that we adopt as working document, Committee Substitute House Bill 425, 1GH2029/G, Bannister 415, a block.
Okay. Without objection, then we adopted version G.
Look.
Questions, Mr. Baldwin, version G.
Yeah,
Representative Green.
Now, Jim, you indicated that this incorporated some changes that we had suggested. I haven't had a chance to look at it. Is there still the treble damages in $20,000 or $10,000?
Yes. None of the changes are substantive in nature from what we had originally asked the committee to adopt. The changes were making the title more descriptive of the contents. There was some language in here which would have led one to believe that we intended to change court rules, and we did not intend to change court rules. And that language was corrected. There was also, since we followed very closely the false claim statute of another state, there was a way of describing things that's not typical for the way we draft up here. And we didn't catch that, but your lawyers did, and they fixed that. And we don't think it does any harm to the intent of the bill as we offered it. But yes, it does contain treble damages and the $10,000 fine. And that's one of the important aspects of the bill that we would like to have as an enforcement tool.
Okay. Representative Green.
You're asking that you can prosecute criminally on preponderance of the evidence as you would a civil crime, and also having a rather severe penalty for these cases against the state. Is that, I'm wondering, I know you have a problem with securing enough information, but is this preferential? You're not allowing this to happen to someone else, a person who was wronged, it's just the state. There's probably a rationale behind that.
Right. The I guess the motive behind a bill like this is to make it clear that when you are seeking a benefit or some kind of a financial or proprietary right from the government, that you do so honestly and straightforward manner, and that just the act of being dishonest about it should carry with it a heavy burden. So that's basically the motive here. The reason why we would like to have this kind of a statute is that these claims of misrepresentation or defrauding the government are difficult to prove in some instances. It's often easier to prove that someone was dishonest than it is to prove how dishonest they were. And the threat of being able to assess a heavy damage for that dishonesty, in our view, particularly in the cases that we're focusing on, are cases against large financial institutions who either can bury you with documents to the extent that it's very difficult and very expensive to prove how they may have defrauded you or misrepresented things to you, or they have cooked their books to such an extent that it's, again, very expensive and very time-consuming to prove the extent of their misrepresentation, that the fear of being brought in under a statute where you can assess treble damages will cause a settlement of the claim more than likely than having to litigate it clear to the end point, which is extremely expensive and poses a lot of risks for both sides.
Mr. Chairman, and I can certainly understand why you're doing it. That makes a lot of sense. My question, though, is that this makes it easier for a state which has a battery of attorneys as opposed to an individual or a small company who may not. Would that same fear also reduce the chances that this same entity wouldn't try and defraud a small company or an individual? I'm just wondering, why are we preferentially singling out the state to allow this concept,
but not giving it to also to a small private entity as well? Well, I'm not sure that I, on a moment's notice, I come up with a real great answer to that question, other than we are here, we view our jobs, as I say, we in the Attorney General's office, as being trustees of the public fisc, and it's in that role that we are seeking these kinds of powers, and that so it's more or less acting in a fiduciary capacity. So as a protector of the public's property and assets, this kind of a tool seems to me to be justified, that we're protecting collectively the interests of all of the people in not having to pay false claims or not having to see the public's property suffered to loss through fraud or misrepresentation. So that would be my one distinguishing characteristic, I think. There might be others, but that's what I can think of at the moment.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Croft.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Green used battery of attorneys. That's not the accepted term. That's PACs.
I stand corrected.
So you would have two options when somebody presents a false claim, tries to do this knowingly. I'm just using the first one as an example. Present an offer, a false claim for payment. So I say, here's the bill for shipping my car, and I didn't really ship my car, and I'm wanting to pocket that $800 or $1,000. You could either try and criminally, under the criminal standards, hold me criminally liable for fraud, maybe, or not liable, but guilty, really. And you, maybe you could describe why there's some difficulties in there. Or this gives you another tool that you can say, all right, it's hard to get into his mental state and the burden of proof is high. We're just going to go after the civil and get treble damages from you for doing this. This, in effect, gives you another tool. And maybe you could tell me some about what some of the difficulties would be in that case of just going the criminal route.
Well, later on in this bill, first of all, if we go the criminal route and you plead out to that, I can still go back and go after you civilly, and whatever you've admitted to there, if there's been a conviction entered against you, that becomes very strong evidence of your civil liability as well. So they not only operate concurrently, they can operate independently. So the advantage of going one over the other they work independently.
So it's really not picking one or the other that you would most likely do. You would use this as a follow-on to criminal prosecution?
It's possible that we could do that. If someone, Mr. Chairman, if I may, if someone was convicted on, looking here at the later on in the, section I'm looking for is provides that if you have been convicted, it becomes evidence.
Right, it's in the estoppel section.
Yeah, it's in the.
It's
section
3.
Yeah, section 3. Yes, on line 21, page 4. A guilty verdict rendered in a criminal proceeding charging false statements or fraud, whether upon a verdict after trial or upon a plea of guilty or nolo contendere, stops the defendant from denying the essential elements of the civil claim. So once they've been convicted, our burden of proof on the civil side is much lessened.
Well, you've got it. You've got the essential elements there.
Right.
Unless there's some weird defense somewhere or something, it's done. Well, it still would seem to me that a treble damage provision would be useful in that context, but mainly that you didn't have to go through all the criminal and that you could choose to, you can't get me thrown in jail or anything, but you can get treble damages off of it, and that might be an easier way to go, particularly on, $1,000 car moving charge or whatever, where you're not probably going to get me in jail anyway, so why not treble damages and it's just Rule 82 attorney's fees? It's not
yes,
full?
Yes, it's not full. It's just Rule 82. As we, the situation that we have with unclaimed property is that it's a misdemeanor for, say, a bank or financial institution that fails to report its unclaimed property to the state. I don't know of a circumstance where we've ever gone after anyone for a misdemeanor charge for failure to report unclaimed property. But we would have that option to do that. We could also go civilly and as a separate action to obtain treble damages. In fact, in California, the prosecution of unclaimed property has gone more towards the false claim type enforcement than it has the regular statutes which apply for collection of unclaimed property. simply because the treble damages, the ability to claim treble damages is such a strong enforcement tool that the companies are brought to a settlement much sooner than if you have to proceed down the long administrative trail towards claiming unclaimed property.
Senator Murkowski.
Thank you. Looking at subsection 8 under section 2, this is the beneficiary of an inadvertent submission of a false claim, and they find out about the falsity of the claim, and then they've got to disclose it within a reasonable time. So I was looking through to see, well, what do we consider a reasonable time? And if you go then down to section C under subsection 1, it would appear that you can only get the reduced, you're going to be held for treble damages unless you can reduce it somehow. You reduce it down in C if you have furnished the information within 30 days after the date on which the person first obtained that information. Is that what you're going back to, number 8 up there then? Are we saying that if I discover that this has been a false claim and I've been the beneficiary, I have to report to somebody within 30 days?
I think that's a reasonable interpretation of that. We're looking upon that subsection 8 as being our best chance of making this law applicable to a party like the Bank of America, whose activity has occurred before the effective date of this act, if it is enacted. I think that it would be hard to make an argument that, that all the other provisions go back retroactively, but number 8, where the law goes into effect, then the bank has some hard choices. Of course, it can argue that this law doesn't apply to it because of the retroactivity arguments, but I think number 8 then brings them in, and then I think it's a reasonable, your interpretation is reasonable, that the 30 days, which allows you to step down to double damages rather than treble damages, would be the test of reasonableness.
Further questions? All right, thank you, Jim. Anyone else here in Juneau wish to testify on House Bill 425? Anyone on the teleconference line? All right. Public testimony. Further discussion? Further action?
You want a motion, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, I move to substitute House Bill 425, Judiciary, with individual recommendations, and attach fiscal note or notes as applicable.
There's a fiscal notes, zeros. Without objection, the bill is moved. What have you done?
We've moved it. No recommendations whatsoever. Except your individual recommendation.
Give it a due pass so we can all know record.
Move it again. Everyone wanted to move the next bill, you said?
You want me to do something? What is the next bill?
Powers. Powers of the Attorney General.
Ooh. Ooh. Hey, have a something to say about this, do you? I like that number one.
Okay, brings us to Senate Bill 286. You have a member of the Prime sponsors, staff here, present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jim Pound. I'm staff to Senator Taylor. SB 286 primarily has to do with the duties of the Attorney General. Primarily, we're looking at a change that would, in his duties, require him to defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska. We'd also clarify that the duties of the Attorney General would be placed in statute, that his first responsibility would be that. Also, that the legislative power to make appropriations and enact law constrains and limits the Attorney General's authority when he is settling cases, that he basically comes back to us for counting on that. Fairly simple bill, it's only 2 pages, and I will entertain any questions.
Questions for Mr. Pound? Representative Roper.
No questions, Mr. Chairman. I just see if I had the file here. See what we were voting on.
Okay, seeing no questions. And we'll go to Mr. Mark Johnson from the teleconference line.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm an attorney living in Anchorage. I formerly worked there in the legislature doing some things for you folks. Just by way of background and adding a little bit to what was offered by the sponsor staff, the legislation sort of grew out of some work that was done by a subcommittee of the Commission on Privatization that I chaired during the interim. We discovered some things relative to settlement authority that were disturbing, and we thought that there was a need to sort of rebalance the statute so it reflected the extent to which the legislature can and should extend by statute the powers of the Attorney General to act in certain areas. I'm not an expert on the first element, which was added by Senator Donnelly in committee on the Senate side. The latter two I certainly could speak to if you have any questions, but I remain supportive of the legislation and urge you to pass it on.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Can you just briefly speak to the latter two then?
Sure. And now I get the bill in front of me. The second change on page 2, I'm looking here at the that judiciary can be substituted at lines 8, 9, and 10. Section that is deleted, and it grows out of a disparity that arose through our research in an opinion that was authored by the Attorney General back in 1991 in connection with the settlement of the Exxon Valdez litigation. This section, this provision with delete language, which provides, and you can read it as well as I can, or which usually pertain to the office of the Attorney General in a state, we believe that language was too open-ended. It really rendered it was an open-ended grant of authority that was probably inappropriate for a statutorily created Attorney General. And so that's the basis for that. That does remove that section. There could be a necessity if the Attorney General believes, if our law believes that there are powers that are truly essential to their duties, that they could come before the legislature and ask for a specific statutory authority to undertake those sorts of functions. I'm at a little loss to determine what those might be. The department certainly has been aware of the problem and hasn't cited some examples, but anyway, that would be the effect of that, that there would be a necessity for them to ask the legislature for authority to act, which may well be appropriate in as much as the office itself is established in statute. So that's as to the second change. The third item in it really was changed a little bit in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It reads a little better than what we had looked at. As currently provided in statute, there's no provision in statute which addresses the Attorney General's authority to settle cases. And the results that's a very, very broad authority. It tends to be commensurate with the power to initiate litigation. Like I said, the authority can be broad. It can embrace obligations of the state, both financial and otherwise. The final section, they reflected on lines 16 through 20, is an effort to put into statute a limitation on the authority to settle cases. That's the basis of that. There is, as I said, there's no current authority in statute which limits the Attorney General's power to settle cases. So I personally believe that that's an appropriate thing to write into the law.
Thank you, Mark. Questions from committee members? Seeing none. Mr. Quinelli.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Is Mark Johnson going to stay online?
Mark, are you going to stay online?
Yes, I can.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dean Quinelli with the Criminal Division of the Attorney General's Office. I was happy to hear the staff from Senator Taylor's office indicate that their primary impetus for this bill was to include the change on page 1, line 5, which is that the Attorney General shall defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska, and we certainly have no quarrel with that as a proposition. Our trouble with this bill really relates to the other two provisions in it, and primarily the one on page 2, lines 8 and 9, where language looks like fairly innocuous language, or which usually pertains to the Office of the Attorney General, is being repealed. As you know, the Attorney General has a number of powers under state law, under statute, but because the legal actions sometimes get very complicated, there are a variety of situations where the Attorney General really must take action in the public good that isn't specifically provided in statute. And attorneys general all across the country find themselves in this situation where in order to further the public interest, they must take some kind of action, and it's not simply not covered by the statute. Where it is covered, however, is under what's known as the common law. In other words, over a period of really hundreds of years, the courts have developed a set of principles that they say generally go along with the Office of the Attorney General. The Attorney General is the government's primary legal advocate. The Attorney General has the responsibility to take certain actions on the public's behalf. And so courts have said these kinds of powers to allow attorneys general to do that are usually pertain to the Office of the Attorney General. In other words, they go along, this is what it means to be an Attorney General. You have these certain powers. I'd like to give you four fairly concrete examples of powers that I believe might very well disappear if this provision were repealed. And three of these, at least, are straight out of Alaska common law. In other words, opinions by the Alaska Supreme Court and the Alaska Court of Appeals. The first one, a number of years ago, there was a matter that the Attorney General decided it was a question of whether the Attorney General should prosecute a particular criminal case. The Attorney General thought that it was appropriate to be investigated and prosecuted, but because of who this particular person was and because of this person's relationship with the administration, the Attorney General felt that there was a conflict in the Department of Law, and so decided to appoint an outside counsel. The names are either special prosecutor or independent counsel. It goes by a variety of names, but the Attorney General appointed someone, actually a former judge, and who's now on the Court of Appeals, but someone to prosecute that criminal case in the name of the state. The defendant, however, challenged the Attorney General's authority to do that. In other words, do you have authority to appoint a special prosecutor? There's nothing in any statute that gives you that authority. And what the Alaska Court of Appeals decided was where the Attorney General got that authority was right from these few words that this bill proposes to repeal. So there really is a question if the Attorney General's office has a conflict and wants to, in prosecuting a particular criminal case, whether the Attorney General would be allowed to appoint special prosecutors the way the Attorney General has now and the way we have done in the past. That's the first example. The second example is, and then that was the last Court of Appeals opinion. I've got the name and citation for those who are interested. Second example is a number of years ago, the Attorney General's office began a consumer protection action against a land developer who was engaged in certain, let's say less than reputable dealings. For one reason or another, the trial court decided that the consumer protection laws didn't cover that particular conduct. So then the Attorney General sort of switched gears and said, okay, there's a statute called the Uniform Land Sales Act, and so under that, we're bringing action under that. And there were a number of consumers who had been defrauded by this particular land developer. And the court said that for a variety of reasons, that particular statute didn't cover the conduct. But finally, what the trial court allowed the Attorney General to do was to bring, under the Attorney General's common law authority, under this particular provision, to bring what was known as a common law fraud action and sue this particular person on behalf